From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks, Rebecca Foster. It's a scorchio tremendo here in Salford. Another glorious afternoon, very warm indeed. Monday's programme, August 10th, 2020. Welcome to it. Brand new week. Lots to talk about today.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
Lots to talk about. Do tweet me, by the way. Tweet me.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children has released statistics around sexual assaults against children, and they are staggering. They are gruesome. And we're going to talk about that this hour with a lady who was first on the programme back in 2016. She is Marilyn Hawes. She's the founder and CEO of Freedom From Abuse. You have to hear this. I'll read the statistics out just before we speak with Marilyn, but they are horrendous. We'll get into that with her this hour. And in the second hour, you may have heard this today, but a statement will be made by the government of Lebanon in a couple of hours' time. In effect, the Lebanese government is going to retire. The government of Lebanon is going to resign, in fact, not retire. That's big news, and we'll get into that with Kevin Barrett, the academic, the author and broadcaster. Kevin Barrett joining me in the second hour. So it's a pretty busy old programme. I did mention Twitter, because you get to have your say there, as you well know. If there's something on your mind, you can tweet it to me, and I'll read out those tweets as we go along. Yes, nice bit of settled weather, although thunderstorms are imminent. We're going to stay away from COVID-19 for a few minutes, although just for a few minutes, because there is some interesting news there. I wanted to get into this yesterday on the Sunday View programme, but I ran out of time. The BBC DJ Sideman, who's a black presenter, a black DJ, quit the BBC, it's one extra station, yesterday because of a racial slur in a BBC news report. The N-word, as it has come to be known, was used in a report about a racially aggravated attack in Bristol. Okay? And he decided that he would quit his programme. He would take a stand against the BBC. Now, the BBC has defended the use of this slur, but the BBC said, well, we accept it does cause offence, but we defend the use of it in the programme. In a video on Instagram, the presenter Sideman said, I can't look the other way. I've thought long and hard about what I'm about to say and what it means. And basically, he quit his programme. The BBC said, he's an incredibly talented DJ. We're disappointed he has taken this decision. I would call him a moron, but then you would expect nothing less from me. It was in a news report. It was a quotation. Context was obviously apparent. This is virtue signalling in the extreme by this guy. Probably motivated by the Black Lives Matter phenomenon, which we've been looking at. Obviously, we've been bearing witness to in recent weeks. Now, LBC Radio station, London, but it's a national station these days, has given the Labour MP David Lammy a radio show. Talked about this last week or the week before. And I've been bleating on about this for years. It's bad enough when radio stations stop doing their jobs and asking questions of politicians. But when they give politicians their own radio shows, well, they're properly taking the piss out of us, right? I've talked a lot about it. Here's David Lammy, these days of LBC Radio, talking about the N-word, David Lammy, and why it should be banished.
You cannot say Black Lives Matter. You cannot have organisations say that we go along with the sentiment of that term, that idea, that belief, and then think it's okay for journalists to just flippantly use the N-word. And the reason is, it's actually probably the most offensive word in English.
It's offensiveness.
Begun in the 17th century when the word Negro changed to the N-word as a deliberate way to brutalise, to be violent to black people.
Yes, but what if a reporter is reporting on a case and somebody has been sentenced for using racially aggravated language? Surely the reporter can say the word, surely, because the reporter isn't assigning the word to somebody, isn't calling somebody the word, isn't attempting to dehumanise somebody. Apparently not, not according to David.
People were lynched. They were castrated. They were stripped of all dignity. My ancestors moved from one...
And that was just the Irish.
...plantation to the next. Your family could be separated. And that was because you were the N-word.
And I say the word, man.
And here we are in 2020. And it's okay for journalists to use that term.
Well, it's not okay, obviously, because you wouldn't be rabbiting on LBC about it. It should be okay in context.
On a broadcast that I'm paying for, by the way, with my licence fee.
Ah, Jesus wept, wind it up.
Unacceptable. I'm pleased that the Director General has finally issued an apology, but I'm staggered, frankly.
Staggered.
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 Staggered. That it's taken days to get the apology out of him.
Apologise to who, though? Who are you apologising to? A reporter said this person used this word aggressively and was found guilty of it, rightly, and has been fined, rightly. So what's your problem?
Of him. Thank you, Sideman. Thank you.
Thank you, Sideman, for giving up your job. You buffoon!
Thank you for standing up and saying enough's enough. Turning down a salary, I suspect.
Yeah, he's a proper agent, huh?
At the BBC to make a statement and say enough is enough. Thank you for doing that. And thank you to the...
Are you going to feed his children now?
To the 18,000 people that called in and complained. They pay their licence fee and they shouldn't have to listen to this horrible racist slur.
My God. The word is nigger. That's the word, right? Is it like Peter Pan, do you think? Remember in Peter Pan... When is it Wendy or is it Tinkerbell? Is it Tinkerbell? I can't remember. Every time a child says, I don't believe in fairies, there is a fairy somewhere that falls down dead. Is it the case that whenever somebody says the word nigger, a black person falls down stone dead? Really? Come on, it's a word with letters, six letters in it. And when you put them together, you get the word. You can't retire the word. It's not like the number of a basketball legend. Nobody wears 23 in Chicago, right? Right? Or in Los Angeles these days, maybe. But you can't eliminate a word. It's an important word. In context. Surely it can be used in context. But apparently not. Anyway. I'm not going to get into Dawn Butler, the Labour MP who was stopped in her car in London over the weekend by the police. She filmed it. She filmed herself admonishing the police. And she's been on every television show in the world today saying that the Metropolitan Police is institutionally racist. I don't know if it is. I suspect it probably isn't, but I don't know. We'll move on. It's a word. That's all it is. And people shouldn't go around using it against people to hurt them. It's a dehumanising word. It's got a terrible past. But there are times when it's necessary to say it. All right. I had a laugh yesterday. Meant to share this on Sunday View, but I ran out of time. Tropical nights, apparently. We're experiencing tropical nights. Did you realise that in the UK? We're having more tropical nights in the UK than ever before. 'Tis boiling, allegedly. And it's made possible, this tropical nights have been made possible by climate change. Here's Dr. Elizabeth Thompson of Reading University. She's a climatologist. On the BBC yesterday morning, made me laugh. Elizabeth Thompson, Reading Uni, what the hell is a tropical night?
So a tropical night can be defined as a 24-hour period in which the temperature does not go below 20 degrees. So overnight, when we don't see the usual drop to colder temperatures that we would see in the UK. And currently, the hottest night on record for the UK was recorded in Brighton on the 3rd of August 1990 at 23.9 degrees.
And are they becoming more frequent?
Yes. Yeah, so currently, they're not a common occurrence.
Currently, they're not a common occurrence.
So a recent Met Office study found that in the 30 years between 1961 and 1990, there were just 8 nights that could be considered a tropical night in the UK. In the 10 years between 2008 and 2017, there were four such nights. And in 2018, there were two warm nights that stayed above 20. So we've seen an increase from 8 in 30 years to 1 every 2 years or so. So we're expected to see this continued increase in frequency as well.
Right. Tropical nights. The BBC presenters couldn't wait to ask the inevitable question, which is about CC. Is it all related to climate change?
And Elizabeth, is that linked to climate change?
Good girl.
Yes. So the short answer is yes, it is linked. We can expect to see more tropical nights as our climate continues to warm overall. So on average, the hottest day in each year over the recent 10-year period is 0.8 degrees warmer than it was when compared to earlier decades. And recently, we've had some of the hottest days on record. So Friday last week was the third hottest day on record. And this Friday just passed was the hottest August day on record since August 2003. So for context, 9 of the 10 hottest days on record have actually occurred since I was born. And since 1990, the average number of days above 30 degrees has increased from 5 to 9. So with these hotter daytime temperatures, as they accumulate over a course of several days, you see an increase in the hotter tropical nights. So without stopping human-induced climate change, these levels of summer heat and humidity will become more regular and make it more dangerous for us to be outdoors.
I want Elizabeth on my pop quiz team. I think she'd be brilliant with all that information retention and all those numbers.
What a shithouse the presenter is, eh? Questioner on tropical nights? No. Patroniser instead about quiz teams. Tropical nights. I'll believe in tropical nights and climate change when we start tripping over geckos and salamanders. And when we can't sleep because of the incessant chirping of the crickets. Give over, you know. Pull the other one. And while he's patronising her about quiz teams, he neglected to ask her to repeat the very last thing she said, which was comedy gold. Did you hear it?
And humidity will become more regular and make it more dangerous for us to be outdoors.
Yeah, you heard that. Humidity will become more regular, making it more dangerous to be outdoors.
And humidity will become more regular and make it more dangerous for us to be outdoors.
Stand next to me, Elizabeth. You've got the Thompson family over there. You need 15 points to win the big money and the car. We asked you, name the dumbest, most ridiculous claim ever made by a climate change to prove that climate change is real. You said humidity will become more oppressive, making it more dangerous to be outside. Our survey said... Yeah, that's garbage, isn't it? Isn't it? Garbage. Hey, in case you were wondering if Bill Gates donates to the University of Reading, of course he does. Of course he does. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation does, and if you don't believe me, you can use a search engine and find out yourself. You would have heard Rebecca Foster on the news telling you earlier on that Boris Johnson has said it's a moral duty, a moral responsibility for the children to go back to school in September. Children in Scotland are due to return to school very soon, next week in fact. Here is Boris Johnson on the moral duty.
It's not right that kids should spend more time out of school. It's much, much better for their health, their mental well-being, their educational prospects. If everybody comes back, to school full-time in September, it's our moral duty as a country to make sure that happens. The last thing we want to do is to close schools. We think that education is the priority for the country, and that is simple social justice.
Yeah. Now, Professor Carol Sikora spoke to Talk Radio's Mike Graham earlier today. He's a leading oncologist. Nice guy. He always comes across pretty well on television. And he said this about the death numbers. Professor Carol Sikora on the COVID death numbers. Pay attention.
The one thing they still haven't sorted out, there was supposed to be an inquiry. The death numbers are completely discredited. And the real problem, I mean, people are dying, there's no doubt, and it's sad. But a lot of the people that have been labelled as dying from coronavirus didn't actually die. And it was pointed out 10 days ago by an Oxford epidemiologist, says, hang on, you're counting everybody that's got flagged up as testing positive. Whenever they die in future, they're counted as a corona death, even if they've been run over by a bus, even if they die of cancer or a stroke.
Yeah, so Somebody who was diagnosed with COVID back in February, March, April, later on as a heart attack, a stroke, or sadly and tragically, an accident, something happens to them, a car crash, they're listed as dying of COVID. They admitted this themselves. The numbers are absolutely flawed. They're unimaginably ridiculous, the numbers. And really, when it comes down to it, as we know this, you and I, the vast majority of people who died from a virus or a respiratory infection, they died in care homes. And they died in care homes because they were locked in there. And I don't have to repeat that. We're tired of saying it. The whole thing is a farce. And yet you have Jimmy Cranky taking to the airwaves every weekday in Scotland to talk absolute pish, as they say, north of the border. Like this, Jimmy Cranky today.
Whenever you are out and about, please continue to think about your own actions, not just in Aberdeen, but wherever you happen to be in the country. Let me remind you that no more than three households should be meeting together indoors at any one time, in each other's homes, and in places like bars and restaurants. It's important to recognise that that household limit applies in places like bars and restaurants just as it does in your own home. And people from different households should be staying physically distant from each other at all times. And again, that's something we advise strongly if you're in a...
Nobody is dying. Very few people have it. The death numbers have been proven to be ridiculous. And yet Cranky bleats on day in, day out. Stay away from people. If it feels like it's normal, there's something wrong. Don't meet with people from other houses. And just keeps going and going and going and going. Isn't it just extraordinary?
If you're in a bar, just as we do if you are meeting other households in your own house. And each of us should be thinking about our recent behaviour, and all of us asking ourselves the question, have we been a bit more relaxed about things like physical distancing?
Listen to that shit. We need to reflect on our own recent behaviour and have a strong word with ourselves. Have we been getting a bit too relaxed about what we've been doing and where we've been going? Madness, this.
When we've been meeting up with friends recently, are we creating more bridges that allow...
Creating bridges to allow the virus to travel across those bridges and into new territories.
This virus to spread, to travel from us to another household or from another household to us.
This is just pure horse shit. How she can keep a straight face saying this stuff?
Because if we are doing that, and I think it is inevitable that many of us will have dropped our guard that little bit, then now's the time to recognise it and try to rectify it. Because the fact is, we all still need to be really careful right now, and Aberdeen is very hard proof of that fact. Nobody's life, while our lives have regained a bit of normality in recent weeks, nobody's life should be feeling absolutely normal at the moment.
Nobody's life should be feeling absolutely normal at the moment. 21 minutes past the hour. Finally for the news roundup, and finally for COVID for the time being. This made me laugh today. Sky News went to a Christian revival in Orange County in California, where people were being baptised in the Pacific Ocean. And it was very interesting. The Christians there are not having the mask wearing. They're not tolerating it. They're totally and utterly reticent to be wearing masks. And some of them spoke to a Sky News reporter in California and explained why. And I loved hearing this.
I think that people should be free to choose whether they want to wear masks or not. And personally, I feel healthier when I don't wear a mask.
I have no fear. There's no fear. I think the news is lying. I'll just say it like that.
About the virus?
Not about the virus, about the numbers and the stats. And everyone I know a lot of people that have gotten COVID, but they're all fine. They're all better. And I know a ton of people that are walking around here that have never been, you know, have not got sick at all.
If you go out, you're not feeling well, that's irresponsible, yeah. But make it a responsible choice.
That. You think people are doing that here tonight?
I would hope so. You know, you can't control it one way or the other. You really can't.
God gave me the word for COVID instead of COVID-19. It's Christ overcoming victory in disease, Psalm 19. You know what? That's what I believe. COVID, yes, if you have a comorbidity, if you have issues, then stay home. But you know what? There was thousands of protesters. They didn't have masks on. So we're protesting for Jesus.
Yes. What a friend we have in Jesus, eh? This is the Richie Allen Radio Show, live with Marilyn Hawes in a couple of minutes' time. Elton John, in the meantime, welcome! Right, music from Elton John, 25 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the programme. Richie Allen with you, live in Salford till 7 o'clock. And this is very, very serious, this. I was reading this morning in the Times newspaper, and then I was watching Sky News, and I came across my first guest today, giving an excellent interview there. She was on the programme, this very programme, about 3.5 years ago. Let me very briefly give you the figures that were published by the NSPCC, the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. They're staggering figures. 449 sex offences committed last year, in the last 12 months, against babies before they turned 1 year old, would you believe? UK police forces recording last year 73,500 crimes, rape, online grooming and sexual assault against children. Very similar to the previous year, but up 57% in the 5 year period from 2015. 8,000 offences against 14-year-olds, while 12,500 sex crimes recorded against children under 10. This is in the last year, and girls were 4 times more likely to be victims than boys. 44 of the 45 police forces across the UK released information to the NSPCC, but not Greater Manchester Police, which is interesting, because it's obviously a huge area. And it staggers me. It's a massive increase in 5 years. Let's welcome back to the programme, it's been a while, the founder and CEO of Freedom From Abuse, none other than Marilyn Hawes. Marilyn, thanks so much for giving us your time this afternoon. Welcome back.
Thanks for inviting me, and thank you, because, you know, apart from Sky News, you are the only person who's actually bothered to put this as a frontline main item, and everybody else is covering COVID, which just, to my mind, shows the attitude. You know, let me just make this absolutely clear. Child abuse is a pandemic also globally, but it's unpalatable. And it's certainly unpalatable for the people who have to suffer it. And there is no inoculation to stop it happening. You know, and that is what, you know, these children that are being abused are going to be our next parents. And these figures, they're just numbers. And I would like to see the NSPCC do something to stick its message to the mast and kick a government door in and make some changes that really show that they are doing the job they're supposed to do, which is to protect children. What we do, we are preventing abuse. Now, what does that actually mean? Prevention actually means action. Action before something occurs. And quite honestly, there's not a single government, Ricky, since I've been doing this in now 18 years, no government has ever got to grips with this. Every single government has failed children in this country and their parents.
That's
the reality of it. These are just numbers. These are figures. I mean, these aren't even really real because, you know, I would love to see more boys come out and report. And I'm sure that it's not so far behind the girls. And what is interesting, which is something that hasn't been mentioned in this report, that girls are more likely to be abused by someone in the family, and boys more likely to be abused by someone like a sports coach or a tutor, something like that. And that hasn't come up in this. And of course, since Jimmy Savile, more people have become to believe that, oh, I will be believed. Because it was only about 5 years ago, wasn't it, with Jimmy Savile, and more people are now, yeah, I'm going to tell this. So has it got any worse, or has it always been there and more people are reporting?
There's loads to get into, and we can go till the top of the hour. It was a brilliant interview on Sky News this morning, and the presenter was desperately keen to carry on, but the way television news programmes are structured, as you well know because you've been on dozens and dozens over the years, they give 6 or 7 minutes to every item. And just when it's getting really interesting and really important, I mean, you brought up things about grooming and political correctness, and we can get into those in the next half an hour. Marilyn Hawes is our guest. On the lockdown itself, I've been reading, I mean, I read the tabloids and the broadsheets every day, as you do, for the job, for producing the radio show. And I've been reading a lot about incidents of sexual abuse going up in lockdown, and accusations have been made against this government and governments around Europe that they didn't really think about vulnerable children and even vulnerable women during this period, that, you know, the lockdown was happening.
Also vulnerable men.
And vulnerable men,
because
right.
Men also can be involved with toxic women. And I'm sorry, I was in a domestic abuse marriage for 19 years, so I know what it's like to be the woman who suffered it. But I am also on the side of men who suffer and are also killed and beaten up by toxic women. So I would love to see, I mean, I'm actually supporting a United Nations campaign called Split the Difference, where we actually stop the gender bias. You know, abuse is wrong, whether you're LGBT, a cross-dresser, whatever you are, it's wrong. It is wrong. And there are so many religions where behind the facade of the religion, this abuse goes on. There's no one's Bible or Quran that actually says abuse is okay. It's not okay. And men are abused as well, and boys. And I mean, my three boys were. You know, yeah. They didn't want to talk about it. Boys and men, there's something that blocks them, and I really push forward with this, because during this time of lockdown, when lockdown came and no one was allowed to go out, I immediately wrote to Priti Patel and I said, oh, brilliant. No one's allowed to go out. Fine. But what about those people that are living in domestic abuse? What about the children that are witnessing it? So I have written a course on the impact of children witnessing domestic abuse. There'll be some people in lockdown that didn't even know they had a problem.
Yeah.
But 50% of children in a domestic abuse situation are also abused. Now, we know that domestic abuse has rocketed globally by 20%, and it will be more than that, because the trouble is with domestic abuse, and it is cultureless, global, across all economies and financial situations, it's embarrassing. I didn't tell anyone for years when I was in a domestic abuse marriage. I had this posh, lovely five-bedroom house. I was a deputy head teacher. I smiled on my way into work every day. Why should I have been embarrassed? But there's something when you are a victim of any form of abuse, because also you've been told it's your fault and you've been told you won't be believed. And bit by bit, you're dumbed down. So these figures that the NSPCC, and for goodness sake, this is a charity that's been around for 4 or 5 decades, they should have got on top of this by now, shouldn't they?
How can they? This is the thing. Let's get to the crux of it now.
Oh, yeah.
The numbers are absolute. They are staggering to me that it can
they,
be.
They're appalling. But the thing is, you know, the prevention. So let's talk about offline abuse first, okay? So we've had these cutbacks for yonks, haven't we? And
yeah.
That has meant police have not been able, they've been cut back. They haven't been able to be trained in the relevant courses. Training budgets have been cut. Social workers have been cut. Their workload is horrendous. There are some brilliant social workers. There's some rubbish ones, but that's the same in teaching. It's the same in your profession. You'll get really good journalists and really rubbish ones. It's how it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've got to bear in that mind that with these cutbacks, when Theresa May was in, this is some of the problem, because the training budgets to get to grips with how child exploitation actually works, you know, on the streets, the exploitation gangs, the relevant training wasn't there. You know, it wasn't appropriate. And what is actually even worse also, and I've been speaking to a chief constable about this, is that I didn't know until about 3 years ago that a newly qualified, say, police officer, for the first 2 years, they have no child protection training whatsoever. And they're out on the streets. And they're going into domestic abuse situations. That, you know, excuse me? I'll tell you what, let me tell you this. If this wasn't so awful, honestly, Ricky, it would be funny. But this is how bad it is, right? I don't know if you've heard of a thing called gaslighting, have you?
Yes, yeah, of course, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine. So I go on, I know I'm nuts, my kids think I'm bonkers, but I like to go out on ride outs with the police, right? So you go and cover a shift, and when an alarm call comes in, out you go, 999, Nina, Nina. We get to this house where there's this lovely young lady there, I won't tell you where it was. She was 25, she was Canadian, and she'd been in this country 15 months, but she'd hardly been outside of her house. And we're there, and there's the
a lady police officer, and there's a gentleman there who was in the force, had been in the force for 7 years. This is January 2020, okay? So the lady starts saying, I think I've been gaslighted, okay? So I thought, oh, ding dong, I've had that. So I thought, I'll just sit, I'm not going to say anything, I'm observing, that's my role. The gentleman officer said, gaslighting. So he said, madam, have you had your central heating check?
No way. Are you serious?
This was 7 months ago. He'd been in the force 7 years. I mean, the poor woman just looked, and then he stands on his, he sits there with his mobile phone, Googling gaslighting. Oh, as if she's now lost all confidence. Unbelievable. And that's just one incident. I could write a book.
So you
and
have,
then you've got the issue as well, you see. The schools, I feel so sorry for the schools. They know, because they've been trained in education, they've been trained in child psychology, they've been trained in child development. They know what, most of the time when there's a child at risk, something not right. What do? They ring up social services, which seems to be now the default for the police. If the social services say there's no case, well, they're not the investigating body, the police are. But the police take their cue from social services. So then you get told from social services, doesn't meet our threshold.
What does that mean exactly, Nomar? When a school highlights a child and suspects that the child is in danger, when social services say that it doesn't meet their threshold, what might that mean exactly?
It means it's not bad enough. And I'm going to give you another classic case, right? I mean, I don't know. Well, too bad. I mean, this was a case that happened last year that I was held with a six-year-old boy. And the mother phoned me from down in the southwest. And her son was being poked, shall we say, with another little boy's digit up his bottom, right?
Right.
And this was going on every break time. And, oh, shock, horror, mother goes in, quite rightly. The little boy stops wanting to go to Beavers because the other boy is doing it there. The other boy, who's the, you know, the person that's doing it, he had been banned from children's birthday parties because he was doing it to kids there. But, oh, social services said child's play. Well, I had four children. They didn't play like that.
No, neither did I.
And that's, you know, the threshold. You can wait. If you're not really, 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 really urgent, like, i.e., you know, I have just seen a child be raped, you know, right, bingo, the police come out as well. But if it's someone that I think there's something there, I know there's something there, if it doesn't meet your threshold, and then the police threshold is different again. And then, of course, you've got the Crown Prosecution. And what they're looking for is beyond reasonable doubt. Then the trouble with this, and this is where it gets, this is where it gets wrong. I spoke to a police force about a couple of years ago, and I said, OK, give me a ballpark figure. Say, for every 1,000 cases you look at, you investigate, because that's the other thing. There's never, the expectation isn't managed. Somebody speaks out, someone says, oh, that man or that woman, they're going to get banged up now because I've told the police. Well, no, it's going to take 2 years, because anything over a year of abuse is considered historic. So very unlikely to be any forensics. So the proving is in, are there any other people that have a similar story to tell where the abuse happened in virtually the same way? Fine, so that's what they have to prove. So they said to me, with every 1,000 cases, you know, ballpark figure, how many we have got to prove to Crown Prosecution beyond reasonable doubt? There can be no other reason why that person acted like that. So how many, Marilyn, do you think get past the Crown Prosecution filter? Well, I naively said, I don't know, 400 or 500? No, 30.
30 out of 1,000.
30 out of 1,000. So is the other 970 are walking away with a clean DBS? So of those 30, the police said to me, how many now get a conviction? So those 30, Crown Prosecution think, yeah, we'll probably get a guilty verdict here and get a conviction and a custodial sentence. How many of that 30 do you think get a custodial sentence and a conviction?
I'm going to say 2/3, 20.
3.
Oh my God, so 3 in 1,000 then.
That it is, and it continues to be like that. And that's where, you know, I feel so, the police must be so frustrated because of all the work they have to do. And that is why sometimes the police will even say to people, that, you know, whilst we believe you, this isn't going to get past Crown Prosecution.
Yeah. Here's an uncomfortable question for, not for you now, but for everybody, I think. I don't know how to phrase this, so I'm going to just kind of blurt it out as best as I can. Do you think that we've gotten to a stage, and I don't mean me and you, obviously not me and you, and hopefully not our listeners, but that society, or at least authority, is not so repulsed by the abuse of children as maybe they should be, that it isn't that much of a priority to them? Do you know what I mean by that? I mean, when I don't want to think of a child being abused, and I'm no virtue signaler. If I think of that, it's going to make me upset. I don't want to think about it. It's a horrible thing. As a radio presenter, I've met people over the years, men and women who were abused when they were children, and my heart goes out to them. It's a dreadful thing. I don't want to think about it. But I get the impression, again, because of the failure of the state to act around grooming gangs and other things that we could have talked about, Savile, I just get the impression that when the further up the chain you go, the less bothered by the abusive children people seem to be. Or am I just talking nonsense?
You're not talking nonsense. That's exactly how it is. Do you know what? If I go to someone, not now because it's COVID, if I went to somebody's house for a drink's do, and I've stopped saying what I do because I can almost turn the air conditioning on by telling somebody what I do. Let me tell you, Ricky, and this is the God's honest truth, and if you don't believe me, you can ask a Dr. Graham Hill, who is a criminologist across the globe. He's very, very good. I went on a course with him, and his three bullet points, I said exactly the same thing. Everybody knows a child abuser. It is that prevalent. We can't name them, but somewhere in our friendship group or our neighborhood, you know one. And that is the reality. And the other thing is, you know, our education program is risk awareness. And we hit the button, we hit the nail on the head. Don't forget, my children were abused. I watched a paedophile at play for 17 years, not knowing what I was watching. I talked to them in prison. I want to find out what their childhoods were like, because nobody was born to abuse. Something significant happened in their childhood. They call it ACEs, adverse childhood experience, that actually, and I'm not making excuses, This is the truth. No one's born like this. So in their childhood, they had something awful that happened that came out in behaviours that should be identified even in the infant school. Those behaviours that are maybe overly sexualised behaviours, just off the wall, or a child that is very, very, very closed down. A child that isn't in that lane that you would think a child would usually be. So unusual behaviours. And that's the sort of thing that we do. So as a teacher, I can raise those flags. Every single course we do, we have a disclosure. And now I go into schools, we train the children, because no one is talking to the kids about grooming.
So when you do... Sorry, Marilyn.
It feels to be abused.
This is important, let's stay with this.
We got a disclosure from a 10-year-old girl last year in a school around your area, and her stepfather is now in prison because she hadn't realised... She knew it wasn't right. She was 10 years old, but they haven't had sex. They don't know what it is, but they know it doesn't feel right. And of course, they're told to be silent, and they're told they're dirty. They're told it's a little secret. They're told they'll go into a children's home. They're told mummy will die if they say anything. And so they're dumbed down. And I was talking to the kids about this, you know, quirky feeling in your tummy. You should talk about that. Anyone get this funny feeling in their tummy? You know, maybe you've lost your door key. Maybe you've lost your mobile phone. Yeah. Maybe you haven't done your homework. You've lost your reading. But all those sort of things, you know what I mean? Maybe someone's creeped you out online. You know, tell a trusted adult. Now, I don't say, which is the NSPCC quote, if it's funny in your tummy, tell your mummy. I don't say that because along the 18 years I have traveled, I've seen some mummies who are part of it. So I say to the children, tell a trusted adult. So this little girl did, and she had suffered this for 5 years, and no one in the school had noticed. And all I said was how it felt in your tummy, that uneasy feeling. And I only know that because that's exactly how my boys told, you know, I didn't want to know what he'd actually done, but they said it was this awful feeling, butterflies feeling sick in our stomachs. And that's, if you don't tell children how it feels, how do they know? They have to understand what's going on. They're in the front line. And you look at online crime. Do you know, honestly, Ricky, we did...
we were offering free training online for parents during lockdown on the premise that please don't think your children are safe because while you're working, they're on the internet. The internet was never created for children. That's why it's not safe. It never will be. And the parents have got to step up with these devices. They really have. You know, cover up your webcam. Don't have anyone who wants to be a friend on. I talk to these people in prison. They tell me what they've done and what they do online to trick the kids. Why wouldn't you have our training? You don't want to be me and have a nervous breakdown when you found it so unpalatable that you didn't want to have to think about abuse that your children were. You know, it is a horrible, horrible, toxic subject. But how is it for the kids? Yeah. You know, these are our future families, and it creates adverse childhood experience that lasts for years. You know, the adverse childhood experiences create a lifelong emotional and physical stress, and they can't process it. They don't know what's happened, and then that becomes toxic stress. And we must target these youngsters at an early age. And that, if you know, this is what's not happening. If the government don't change the narrative, which they won't, if the government don't have people around the debate table who have had the lived experience like me and thousands of others, which they won't because they have their cozy little group of big charities that always sit around there, you know, if they're not going to have a radical change in strategy, we'll be having this conversation again in 5 years, 10 years, when I'm 6 foot under, Ricky. Because nobody wants to, you know, if a tree isn't growing, you pick it up and you maybe replant it. You treat the soil, you look at the root. That's what's not happening. What is the root cause? Nobody wants to dig down and examine it because it's not nice. No, it's not nice. But what about the kids?
Let me remind our listeners, the founder and CEO of Freedom From Abuse, Marilyn Hawes, is on the programme. And Marilyn's sons were groomed by their head teacher, somebody that Marilyn knew very well. She's been trying to address these issues now for many, many years. We'll put links out on Twitter, of course, to where you can find her at Freedom From Abuse and the work they do there. You talked this morning on Sky News, and it's very important this, you talked about political correctness. Now, I've interviewed Maggie Oliver, and I've interviewed Sarah Champion, and I've had MPs on. Do you think that, is that, were you thinking of grooming gangs, maybe of, you know, from certain ethnic backgrounds that were able to operate in the Northwest in this part of the world because of sensitivities, of cultural sensitivities? Is that what you were referring to?
I am referring to that as well, but also the lack of training. I mean, I know Nazir Afzal, who's up in your neck of the woods. Yeah. He's one of our ambassadors. I adore the man. He is Pakistani. He sorted out the Rochdale case. And he says the same thing to me. He said, I am Pakistani, but I don't agree with this going on. White men do this as well. White girls are involved in these gangs as well. But you cannot get away. I am not racist. I couldn't give a monkey's if you're blue with pink spots on. It doesn't bother me. But if you're going to touch kids, then it bothers me. But, you know, it is predominantly more in that culture, Asian and Bangladeshi culture. It is. You can't get away from it.
There's no denying it.
And I am not being racist. That is a fact. But go back to Maggie Oliver's time, then unfortunately, you know, everybody was terrified of telling the truth and saying the truth, and they were dumbed down. You know, but you've really got to look around at the Rotherham. You know, there were some police officers involved in it.
Yeah.
This is a crime. Child sexual abuse is a crime from top down, as wide as you like to go.
And you said there to me, you said to me,
at the wrong side of the tracks.
You said to me a moment ago that everybody knows somebody who is, you know, tending to abuse or who is likely to abuse or be an abuser. Now, we might actually not know they're doing it.
Yes.
Again, do you know what that says to me?
What would tell you, and this is why our training is so important. Once you see how they operate so subtly in plain sight, you can recognize it like Rudolph's nose. It's not rocket science. Honestly,
in a heartbeat you get it, because we demonstrate it. We have great big teddy bears that we just do unusual lap sitting, unusual tickling games,
yeah.
All sorts of little things that make people go, oh, that's creepy. There you are. Yeah. You've got it. It's creepy. Now what are you going to do with it? You know, your creepy, that feeling in your stomach, that is your internal alarm.
I hope we've not lost Marilyn.
Your second brain.
We just lost you momentarily.
You're right.
You know, we just lost you for 5 seconds there. You were talking there about, you were talking about the feeling inside that something is creepy, that it's wrong. And we just lost you momentarily there. Can I just ask you this? Because we've got another 10 minutes, but the numbers. I'm not trying to sensationalise this. If there are 65 million people living in the country, I don't know how many adults are living in the country. Let's say there's, I don't know, let's make it up. Let's say 35 million adults, people over 18 live in the country. What percentage of adults are likely to be thinking about children sexually? I mean, how...
You have no idea. 60% is never reported. You've got 60% is never reported. So these figures are not accurate in real terms. These are the figures where the youngsters have gone to the police. Right? These are official figures. So, it wouldn't be like me saying to my best friend, oh, you know, I was sexually abused by my uncle. That sort of report won't go into these figures because these are the reported figures that have gone through the police records. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
60% never gets reported. So it's worse than this. There are about 12 million children in the country, okay, approximately. There's about 9 million in our education system. So say 12 million. Of that 12 million, 1 in 20 of those children, 12 million, are reporting sexual abuse. The 1 in 5 are reporting any other type of serious abuse. Now, the thing about child sexual abuse and all abuse, it's like the Olympic rings. You know, one overlaps into the other, and you can't actually dissect it because with sexual abuse will come emotional abuse, will come probably verbal abuse, will come physical abuse. They all link. And when you have domestic abuse, someone in that mix is being raped or sexually abused. Every time.
What do we know about it historically? Has this always been part of the human condition? You know,
oh God, yes. It's the brokenness in society, and the trouble is, it does go down to your upbringing. I mean, is it nature? Is it nurture? No one is born to abuse. And if you wanted to prove that, you would have to give every baby an MRI scan. True to say that. Children that have alcoholic mothers or, you know, heroin addicts, there is a problem called a fetal alcohol syndrome. But apart from that, no one is. Something happened that made the, I use it like, if you imagine a ball of Play-Doh, and I use this in my courses, here's a baby's brain. Now, when there's trauma, and that's another thing that came up in this report about counselling, these youngsters and adults that have been abused don't need counselling, like how does it feel? It's trauma. They have post-traumatic stress disorder. They don't need ordinary counselling that the doctor, NHS, does. They need proper trauma therapy to overcome it, to process it and come out the other side. But that is what they need. And I lost the track of what I was saying building into that. I'm sorry, but
You're making perfect sense. And but we're having a lot of tweets on this, understandably. One of the things that's come up on this programme recently is there is a group of people on Twitter that are becoming more prominent, and they call themselves minor attracted persons. And they seem to be seeking some sort of validation or recognition from everybody else. You know, they call themselves minor attracted persons. We don't abuse children, but we have feelings for children. And a lot of my listeners are offended by the term minor attracted persons because they believe that somebody who's attracted to minors is a de facto paedophile. And they are.
Let me stop you there.
Go ahead.
This is a fact that if you have had sexualized feelings for 6 months or more, and you haven't acted out on it, but you have feelings, you are paedophilic. Now, there is a wonderful charity, the only one in the country, called Stop It Now. There is no reason why someone can't go and call Stop It Now or the Lucy Faithful Foundation. It's there to help people who really feel they may abuse, don't want to do it, and, you know, and just need help. It's there for them. So, you know, don't tell me you got minor attraction. Sorry, get yourself sorted. It's a crime, and it should be, and it breaks lives. It steals children's innocence. It breaks their trust. Till the day I die, Ricky, I shall still be banging on about this. And the fact that people don't want to step up and do every bit they can to stop another child. You know, that little girl that I mentioned up near your neck of the woods, where the stepfather is now in prison. Do you know what? If I only have ever saved one person, that's made my oxygen worth it. The children rely on us. That we are the only people they have who they rely on to help them. You know, you have Crime Stoppers you can talk to anonymously. If you don't want to, like, I can understand you don't want to put your neck on the line and say, well, my guy next door, I think, you know, a chap down the road or whatever. You can report it. We are linked with Crime Stoppers UK. We're affiliated with them. It's anonymous. You know, but you do not want to wake up one day and go, oh, wish I'd said something. Oh, my golly, I wish I'd said something.
Just say
and
something.
And the grooming is important. It's so important that people understand it and get to grips with it.
And you said today, Marilyn, you said today on Sky, and I'd like you to come back on the show in the near future and do... And maybe do a bit about grooming and what it is, because we're going to run out of time in a minute, and there's a couple of quick questions I want to ask you. These minor attracted persons seem to want to define themselves as a sexuality, right? That basically to place themselves alongside gays and lesbians and transgenders. They want to be kind of normalised. Now, wait for it. And there seems to be an increasing movement, and this has been around for years, but it seems to be coming back. A desire to kind of to lower the age of consent, which is obviously a huge problem, and secondly, we don't have time to get into this, but we can get into it in the future. There is a new relationship and sex education course for children coming in this coming term in here in the UK, and some of it. And I'm not a conservative Christian. I'm not. Some of the stuff they want children to be talking about, I don't think is any place being discussed around children. And I think it definitely paves the way for the sexualization of children. I think the curriculum, where they're going with this, you know, while I agree with you that you should give children the tools to know if somebody is grooming them, I also don't think you should be getting children to sit down and talk about sexual acts, you know, when they're five, six, or seven.
You know, we've written a course because I am aware of what comes up, you know, with the keeping children safe in education. I'm, you know, if you want to abuse children, this is the other thing, you work with them. Go into a sex offender prison and talk to them like I do and ask them when they first became attracted to children. Ask them at what point did they choose a career that would put them in the front line. It'd make your hair fall out. They started fiddling when they were about 11, and they started choosing their careers as a deliberate act to be doctors, nurses, priests, whatever, at age 16, 17. You don't... A teacher doesn't become a paedophile. The paedophile becomes a teacher. You know, if I'm an alcoholic, I'll go to the pub. I'm not going to go to the newsagent, am I? Yeah. It's not rocket science. They are everywhere. And when you've looked at those figures of only 3 out of 1,000 approximately get a conviction and the others walk away, there's thousands of them out there, thousands and thousands that we don't know about. But I tell you, every day walking down the street, you'll pass one. And if they're not doing it offline, see, the thing is now, go back a few years, 5 years, if they were online offenders, then the ratio was really like maybe 1 in 3 were hands on. But now the two are fused. Online, offline have fused. And I go into schools with 7-year-olds that have got iPhones. In a class of, an average class of, the, say, year 3 7-year-olds, I say, how many of you have been infiltrated with a nasty image or a nasty message by a grown-up? In your average class of 30 children, it's at least 6 or 7 children that put their hand up. The faces of the teachers, they just want their jaw to drop.
Yeah. My jaw has dropped.
We do it differently. We approach it differently. We get outstanding results. And you cannot run away from this. And it's irresponsible of adults to run away from it. You know, where are my grandchildren? I've got eyes everywhere. Everywhere. And do you think, you know, who's in the swimming pools at the moment? No one's doing it, are they? But I took my little grandson about 2 or 3 years ago to a reading room, you know, in the library. And I saw this guy, and he's standing there, and he's by the science books. And it just happens to be where the children are sat having their little reading and play. And I was just watching him, and I thought, you're taking a long time. The next Thursday, he's back there again. And I thought, what's the coincidence of that then? So I thought, if you're back here next time, I'm reporting you. So I did. And guess what? He was out on license.
No way.
Yeah, they're there.
Christ,
you will see them. So I tell you, when you know what I know, you smell it.
Tell me
it's
this.
The behaviour is something that gets in your gut. And you just know. You just know when something's going down.
Imagine
that.
You,
what you have to do.
Imagine that. You phoned up about him and the guy was out on license. Last question, 30 seconds to answer it, and thanks for giving us your time today, I appreciate it.
Oh, please, ask me back, I've loved
it. Oh, no, I will, in a heartbeat, yeah. I'm going away for a few weeks next week, and with your permission, in September, we'll get into grooming. Final question for you. Again, you might think it's a bit cheeky, but I'm going to double down on this. For me, and this is just my opinion, I am a layman, I do not have your expertise or your experience. For me, the ruling classes are very comfortable around child abuse. And that's how I feel. And maybe that's some kind of sort of explanation as to why this gets worse and worse and worse every year and nobody does anything about it. Yeah.
You're not wrong. It's right from the top down. You know, judges, police officers, you know, you name it. Teachers, top down and wide. It's not just, you know, it is the ruling classes, the hierarchy. It's there. You know, Westminster, it's there. It's there. And, you know, what I'd love to see, you know, I wouldn't wish child abuse on anyone's child. But I tell you, if some minister had 3 of their children sexually abused, the law would change.
Do you remember years ago, he's dead now, but Edward Heath's former chief whip, Tim Fortescue, admitted on the BBC that some politicians would come to the whips in the 70s to say, get me out of trouble, I've been abusing young boys. And he said they would get them out of trouble because they could use that bit of leverage over that child abusing MP in the future. It's sick, this stuff. And I really,
and I've also, yeah. I hate to say this, and I might offend people by saying this, but, you know, I have a real problem with certain lodges of the Freemasons.
Well, why would you offend? Listen, this is a free speech platform.
People don't like people being honest, do they? But I just tell it like it is. And, you know, they look after their own.
Listen, Marilyn, come back again real soon. And
oh,
thanks for doing
it. And have a great time away. Well deserved. Thanks so much, Ricky.
Great to have you on, Marilyn. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye for now. 4 years ago, the last time Marilyn was on the programme. Great to have her back on too. Long. She's a founder and CEO of Freedom From Abuse. And her 3 boys were sexually groomed by their head teacher. And Marilyn knew the head teacher very well. It was a devastating thing for her to come to terms with. Freemasons, eh? I know there'll be listeners listening to this. See? I never deny that. We've had listeners, we've had guests on the programme over the years who've talked about secret societies and child abuse. She said it herself there, the ruling classes and child abuse, they're very comfortable. A lot of people in the so-called ruling classes are very comfortable around child abuse. They don't have any problem with it. And they don't see anything wrong with it. And I asked that question earlier on. Are we in a situation where those charged with protecting children, be it the upper echelons of policing, judiciary and so on, are they not so bothered by it? She said, yeah, you're right. They're not bothered by it. They're not repulsed or sickened or nauseated the way you are or I am. Doesn't bother them. Just listen again to the Tim Fortescue bit. It's the most extraordinary bit of audio ever captured by the BBC. The nonchalance of it. Yeah, when guys would be abusing children, we would get them off because we would store up the brownie points, he said. You know, they weren't disgusted by the person standing in front of them. If it was me or you, you'd want to vomit all over them. And then knock them out. And then hand them into a police station. No, they weren't repulsed by it. It was like, ah, boys, and you got caught, you silly sod. Well, we'll get you out of it. And next week there's a big vote on, I don't know, the price of orange juice or something. And you'll vote the way we want you to vote. Mad times, 5 minutes past the hour. Yeah, a lot of people call me Ricky. When they're from down south. They like Ricky down south, don't they? Ricky. Thanks for that, Chris Morrell. Right, music from Patti Smith then. This is her version of Bruce Springsteen's Because the Night. Back with your comments, and then Kevin Barrett will join us to talk about Lebanon.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
The views and opinions expressed on The Richie Allen Show are those of the guests and the guests alone. They do not necessarily reflect the position of the host or other contributors.
Welcome back to Your Richie Allen Radio Show, Monday's programme. It's exactly 10 minutes past 6. Kevin Barrett will join us very soon to talk about developing story. The government of Lebanon has resigned this afternoon. Told you about that at the top of the programme, that it was imminent. The announcement was made in a national television address by the Prime Minister of the country, Hassan Diab, a short time ago. This, of course, following on from the blast, the explosion in the port last week, which led to the deaths of over 200 people and injured many, many more, put down to the storage of over 2,500 tonnes of ammonium nitrate stored at the port for some years. That's what the government said. Anyway, we'll talk to Kevin about that momentarily. Thanks for your tweets on what Marilyn Hawes had to tell me. You can chat with others on Twitter by going to where it says search Twitter, put Richie Allen Show, all one word, in. If you press enter, you'll see what people are tweeting to me, and you can engage in conversation with them if you choose. Or if not, you can just be, I don't know, a lurker. I think that's what they call them, a lurker. Let's get Kevin Barrett on the programme. He needs very little introduction. He is an academic. He is a researcher, author, teacher, and broadcaster, of course. You can find out all there is to know about him at truthjihad.com. He is a very good friend of mine and has been gracing my radio programmes for more years than I care to remember. Let's welcome back the great Kevin Barrett to the programme. Kevin, it's all happening. Welcome back, first and foremost. The government of Lebanon has resigned. This was announced by Reuters this afternoon over the explosion that killed so many people last week, that they themselves put down to the detonation of ammonium nitrate stored unsafely at the port. We're going to get into all of this and your opinions on it as well. How significant is it, do you think, the government stepping aside this afternoon, Kevin? And welcome back again.
Well, thanks, Richie. It's always wonderful to be on your show. One of the great radio shows, maybe, you know, at the very top of the list of all radio shows in English in the world, as far as I'm concerned.
No, thanks, Kev.
And I'm not just buttering you up here. I really love your show. So, you know, we don't know where this is all going with Lebanon right now. There are all sorts of possibilities. You know, I think the future is kind of wide open. I do think that this nuclear bomb, which I think is probably what it was, that was set off probably almost certainly by Israel with the connivance of American forces in the port of Beirut, was designed to get regime change. But I don't know if they're going to get the kind of regime change they want. They're essentially trying to get rid of Hezbollah, but Hezbollah is the most effective organization in Lebanon. and an integral part of the country, and of course the most effective component of their armed forces as well. So I don't think they're going to succeed at that, but it's really a crazy push. And of course they're also trying to make sure that Lebanon doesn't join the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. And we can get into the details about how the explosion would tie into that. But I don't think that this resignation is going to lead to a U.S. and Israeli puppet government in Beirut. So that's what they want, but we'll see how it all winds up.
Yeah, definitely. I was watching UK news yesterday, and it's through my own personal journey through the independent media when I left the mainstream that I began to become a bit more skeptical about how news is created. And I was looking at people on the streets of Beirut speaking to American and English news cameras, speaking out against the government. And some of these people were very, very sophisticated. Now, I'm not suggesting that people from Lebanon are not sophisticated, but their English was word perfect. They were immaculate. And I began to think it's almost as if somebody placed them there, you know, to say, to kind of spew out all this anti-government rhetoric. And I just don't like it. We've seen it over the years in Egypt. We've seen it in Libya. We've seen it in so many places where these people who claim to be Libyan or claim to be Afghani, and, you know, they're very eloquent and brilliantly able to execute a soundbite and say how rotten the government is and we want change. And we can talk about that in a moment. On the strike itself, I don't pay too much attention to videos that I see on Twitter because it's so easy to manipulate videos. But I will concede that when you look at the actual explosion from video sources that seem to be fairly genuine, from CCTV and that, it looks wrong to me. It looks like something hit that warehouse. It looks like something hit it externally, but I'm no expert and I could be talking through my backside. As for a nuke, you've taken a bit of flack, and I was gently teasing you yesterday on Twitter. I've the utmost respect for you. It's the Mutual Appreciation Society here. But you've taken quite a bit of stick from many of your own followers who are saying, come on, Kevin, a nuclear device, where's the evidence to support any of that? I'm going to put my hands up, Kevin, and I'm going to give you plenty of time to obviously to say what you want. You know, you're free to say what you want here. You'll get all the time you need. But I've seen absolutely no evidence to support the idea that a nuclear device or a thermonuclear device was used. Why do you feel that might have been the case?
Well, I'll have to admit right off the bat, Richie, that I'm not 100% sure of my scenario. And I'm certainly not 100% sure that it was a nuclear device, because I don't really know enough about the latest generation of nukes to be confident in, you know, looking at something like this and figuring out what it was. I do have colleagues over at Veterans Today who are much more expert at that than I am, but even they have their differences of opinion. I was recently talking with Gordon Duff, both on and off my radio show, about this. He's convinced it was a nuclear device. And clearly, you know, there were backpackable nuclear devices all over the place in 1960. And the new generations of nuclear weapons are nothing at all like the 1950s style, you know, hydrogen bombs and the Hiroshima bomb and things like that. They're much more sophisticated, and they can be dialed up and down in terms of explosive power, in terms of radiation signature. You can have neutron bombs that are nothing but radiation and practically no explosion, or you can have explosions with virtually no radiation. And, you know, Gordon says that the radiation is gone in less than 2 days from the latest generation of the kind of thing that he thinks Israel used. In any case, I think it was clearly some kind of special weapon. And that's what Terry Mason calls it. Terry Mason was a leader or an early author in the 9/11 truth movement. And he has a good connection with intelligence agencies over in that part of the world. It's rumored that he was with French intelligence, and he resigned to inform France that 9/11 was a false flag coup d'etat. Apparently, that's why Jacques Chirac, who was then the president of France, chose not to join the U.S. in invading Iraq. So Thierry Meyssan is actually a pretty important person, and he's been in Syria for over a decade, I think. Close connections to Syrian intelligence and talks with all the people in the know over there. He says definitely this was some kind of Israeli special weapon. He put pictures up in his article showing the identical mushroom cloud in Israeli bombings of Syria recently, and likewise apparently in Iran and in the Gulf. So Israel is using some kind of special weapon that creates this particular kind of mushroom cloud. That we know. Is it nuclear? I don't know. And Robert Baer, who is the former number one U.S. CIA agent in the region, based in Beirut for a very long time, knows everything about that, went into American mainstream media and said, yes, this was some kind of military weapon. And Trump was told this, too, apparently. Trump blew the whistle on his own military or on his own, you know, deep state community by blurting out exactly what he had been told, which was that this was some kind of bombing. So
he said his generals. He said his generals told him that it was a bomb. There's no doubt about that. But he's also performed pretty badly in television interviews lately talking about coronavirus. I'm beginning to wonder. And I say this with no disrespect whatsoever, even though I don't like politicians full stop, no matter which colours they wear. I wouldn't be surprised if Trump is not mentally stable, to be honest.
Well, I'm certainly not going to argue the case for Trump being mentally stable.
Yeah.
But I do think he's probably blurting out the truth about what his generals told him.
Can I just say this? You and I could never fall out, and we won't. And I'm not going to diss or badmouth your friend. I wouldn't be the biggest fan of Gordon Duff, and I'm just going to leave it there. So I wouldn't trust Gordon personally. Thierry is a different story, but I want to put this to you. Nobody likes to find fault with Israel more than me on radio programs like this. I never give them a pass. I have no time for the country or its government. I separate the government from the people, Zionists, and certainly Zionists from Jews. Why do we, and by we I'm including myself, why do we always jump to the conclusion that it's Israel? What about our countries? You know, a friend of mine who is Jewish and loves the programme and genuinely does and loves reading people like you, loves listening to the independent media, and he's not got any chip on his shoulder about criticism of Israel. But he says, Richie, guys like you and some of your guests, you need to have a good hard look at yourselves and maybe admit that sometimes you're predisposed to just finding Israel. Israel is always the answer, whatever the equation. What about France? What about the United States? What about Great Britain? Our own governments, our countries are no better and certainly no worse. These are his words now, than the Israeli government. He said the Irish government is not a better government, is no more humane or decent than the Israeli government. And yet he said he always concludes it's Israel. It can't always be Israel. And what would Israel have gained by detonating even a brand new type of nuclear device in the port in Beirut? Why leap to Israel? Why not UK? Why not America?
Well, I would agree with the argument that there are people out there who blame Israel and or Jewish communities for a lot more than they should. Absolutely, yeah. That's true. Israel is, they don't have a monopoly on evil in the world, not even close.
No.
Although they may be leading the race in terms of per capita evil by any single state, that's arguable. But, I think we just have to be realistic. And I do think that what you just said was exaggerating in the other direction, because I certainly don't think that the Irish government is remotely equally evil to the Israeli government.
Do you see what the Irish government is doing to its people in Ireland now over this COVID nonsense? It's destroying people's livelihoods, Kev. It's destroying people's futures. It's imposing a totalitarianism on my people, the likes of which we never imagined. My government is basically a group of puppets for Brussels, for the European Union. So I know what you're going to say when you compare that to the concentration camp that is Gaza. You're going to compare like for like, but they're all sick bastards, every single one of them, politicians. As far as I'm concerned, they don't care. The UK government knows that the Saudis are murdering men, women and children that never raised a finger in anger against England. And yet they give the Saudis the most heinous weapons, knowing full well what they're going to do with them. And I just think my mate's right. You know, I have a lot of hostility for Israel, and I always will, and for Zionism, and for some of these banksters that hide behind Zionism, and I'll talk about it all day long. But I think closer to home, our bastards are just as evil as their bastards. That's all I'm saying, Kev.
Well, yeah, I won't argue completely against that. I, in my article, Twilight of the Psychopaths, which may have gotten as much reads over the years as anything I've ever written. Yeah. I started out by saying that the real conspiracy is not, you know, it's not the Zionists or it's not the banksters or it's not this. It's the psychopaths. It's the conspiracy of the psychopaths against everybody else, and specifically the well-organized, high IQ psychopaths who rule the world. And so, yeah, they're, and, you know, that's, maybe there's a slight disproportionate edge there over in Israel compared to other psychopaths. I don't know. But yeah, you're right.
We let them away with it, Kev. This is the worst of it. Sorry for interrupting. I won't interrupt you anymore for the rest of this conversation. We let them away with it. The Irish, you know, Ireland over the years has taken part in resolutions against Israel. You see, I almost admired the Israeli government, much as I hate them. I admire them because it does what it does. It murders and tortures the indigenous people of Palestine. And it does it on a daily basis. It attacks, it has been attacking Lebanon pretty much every day since I've been alive. And it gets away with it because our governments say, oh, you shouldn't do that now. Here's Resolution 20. And then we just go back to eating our cabbage and our ham and drinking our Guinness and we don't give a shit. Like, we don't, there's nothing to back it up. You know, I always said, and I've been saying it since I was 17, since I first came into the media, sanction Israel back to the Stone Age. That's how you do it, but we never do. So I don't blame Israel so much as I blame its partners in crime that, you know, piecemeal criticism. Oh, Operation Protective Edge. Kev, you and me spoke for months about Operation Protective Edge, the mass murder of children from the air by the Israeli Air Force. And you've got arsehole politicians in my country saying, oh, that's terrible now. You know, stupid accents. Country boys, oh, stop that now, it's terrible. But they don't do anything about it. So a part of me says to Israel, fair enough. You know what I mean? It's crazy to think like that, but a part of me says, well, I don't blame them.
Yeah, well, I sometimes think the same way about the entrenched evil here in the United States, where we had the president of the United States, John F. Kennedy, shortly after he had suddenly become idealistic and decent in certain respects, suddenly getting his brains blown out in Dallas. And then a mafia hitman steps through a sea of Dallas police officers and silences the patsy and on live television, and the whole country just lets them get away with it. So, yeah, I mean, you can blame the psychopaths for doing evil deeds, and you can also blame the ordinary people for letting them get away with it. Absolutely. And so, yeah, it's all of our fault that Israel is getting away with all of its crimes, and just as it's our fault that leaders of other countries are doing these terrible things. But if we want to get a little more specific here, you know, Israel is kind of a special case. It's very much founded on an ideology of racist supremacism and a kind of a biblical ideology of genocide, of biblically sanctioned genocide.
Yeah.
And it's carried out by atheists who don't believe in God, but they believe that God told them to go and kill and expel the natives and take this land that belongs to them. So that ideology has led to a settler colonial project on steroids. Settler colonial projects have always and everywhere been all incredibly evil. The French murdered over 1 million Algerians trying to hang on to their settler colony.
That's right.
The Dutch and their settlers did similar things in southern Africa. The British did similar things in East Africa and
Belgium and the Congo.
Rhodesia. And on and on and on. So settler colonialism, where, you know, and this is a phenomenon of you know, the recent history when technologically enabled Europeans went into these countries and sent settlers and basically had to get rid of the natives to make room for the settlers, which meant genocide. And all of those projects failed, and the natives have taken back their lands with one exception, which is in the most symbolically important, religiously important real estate on planet Earth, the Holy Land. And there, the genocide continues. Why is that? Well, that's because the people who set up that genocide are absolutely fanatical, and they have tremendous power, and they will stop nothing. I mean, even compared to these other genocidal cretins and the psychopaths running other countries, these people are really off the charts in terms of their evil and their power. And so it is a special case. And the population in Israel, Richie, they, you know, the ordinary population there will go and sit on the hillsides and watch the white phosphorus raining down on civilians and cheer and barbecue. That's the mentality.
Some of them have done that. Yeah. And it's horrible when you see that. And I think Norman Finkelstein, more than anybody, explained why that's the case. Because there's an indoctrination, isn't there, Kevin? From when the children first go to school, there is an indoctrination. Children are taught in schools that they are oppressed, that they are constantly under attack, that their existence is constantly under threat. And you're absolutely right there. Kevin Barrett is our guest, truthjihad.com, veteranstoday.com. My listeners, as usual, agree with you. They don't agree with me. This is bloody typical. And they talk about PNAC, the Project for New American Century, and Lebanon being on the list. And some of my listeners are talking about resources being, you know, that haven't yet been taken out of the ground in Lebanon. Natural gas is a big deal there. Of course, the Greater Israel Project. There are a lot of reasons why it would suit Israel and of course, why it would suit the West to destabilise Lebanon and to put its own puppet government in. Before we talk more about that, Kevin, Paul Craig Roberts, who's been, like yourself, he's been a guest on this programme for a long time. Paul, very obviously a noted critic of Israel, he believes in his bones that rather than Israel be, you know, controlling through its missionaries in the UK and in America, rather than Israel having the big influence in the UK and in America, which we think it does because it appears to, he thinks that ultimately the neocons are really running the show and that Israel is actually the neocon puppet state in the Middle East. I'm guessing you disagree with him.
Well, you know, it depends how you define neocons. I see the neoconservative movement, which was essentially founded by Leo Strauss,
yeah,
as a school of thought. And that school of thought happens to be dominated by people who are from an ethnic Jewish background, who are atheists. They're all atheists. If you're a neocon and you're not an atheist, you have not understood the school of thought that you pretend to belong to.
Yeah.
And so they're not religiously Jewish by any means, but the great majority and the preponderance of power, both intellectual power and political power in the neoconservative movement, belongs to people from ethnically Jewish backgrounds. And that school of thought is, I guess you could say, in a sense, Israel is very much a neocon project because it was founded by atheists who took the worst aspects of biblical so-called morality and applied them to a project of genocide. And the neoconservative philosophy is a philosophy of evil. Strauss, I believe, actually openly called himself a teacher of evil. He taught that, indeed, people like Dostoevsky were right when they said that if there's no God, everything is permitted. And if everything is permitted, you might as well be rotten on the inside and get away with everything you can while pretending to be a good guy on the outside so everybody likes you. So basically, you rape children in your basement by night, and then you become a pillar of your community by day. And, you know, Strauss was famous for doing a lot of very kinky sadomasochistic things with his students. And so he trained this whole generation of so-called philosophers, self-styled philosopher kings. And so those people, basically, they believe that just grab everything you can in life for yourself. And they kind of enjoy doing a Nietzschean version of this and making up the world as they go along, shining the light on the wall of the cave and brainwashing the masses according to those cartoons. So this is their school of thought. But they tend to like Israel partly because of some kind of atavistic identification. You know, maybe it's their background. They grew up liking Israel. They become atheist philosophers who don't believe in anything except having fun and being evil. And then they, I guess, they just find it convenient to have fun and be evil by hooking in with Zionist power. So I think there is a difference between the state power of the state of Israel and its many connections in the Kosher Nostra worldwide, in governments in the West, and so on. And then the neoconservative school of thought, which is a doctrine in the school of thought. If people want to learn about that doctrine, they should read Canadian professor Shadia Drury, D-R-U-R-Y, who has written extensively about this. So I think that that my friend Paul Craig Roberts is a little off here in that it's not that a school of thought is not the same thing as a state and its power.
Yeah, I must get the two of you on sometime for an hour, not to be, you know, not to be creating a big argument around this, but just to discuss these themes. I'm going to look for that book you just mentioned. I've not come across that. I will read it. For those who are not inclined to want to read books or you don't have the patience to read a book, Kevin has been discussing there as Strauss and the neoconservative ideology that came out of him. You can watch a series of films made by Adam Curtis for the BBC called The Power of Nightmares, which I know you've seen, Kevin, which are outstanding films. They juxtapose the rise of Leo Strauss and his disciples on the one hand, and then Saeed Qutob on the other hand, in the Islamic world. Very interesting series of films. Kevin Barrett is our guest. So Kevin, so the government is gone then. Again, for people who are joining the program late, the government of Lebanon has resigned over the anger being expressed on the streets of the country after the explosion which killed more than 200 people. Kevin is convinced that it was an explosion. A lot of our listeners are as well. They agree with you. They think it looks like an explosion. And fair play, a lot of our listeners are saying, look, you know, we're no experts in explosions, but it looks to us, when you compare it to other explosions, it looks like it was maybe something that was deliberately done. Who knows? But it's not likely in the short term, Kevin, you said earlier on, to give those in the West what they want, which is to see the demise of Hezbollah and the replacement of Hezbollah with some sort of, as you said, puppet government. That's not likely to happen anytime soon, which makes you wonder if somebody did deliberately plant a bomb, or if they bombed it from the sky or whatever, surely they would have known that in and of itself wouldn't be enough to tip the to tip Hezbollah over the edge, as it were. What do you think?
Well, Benny Gantz essentially told Lebanon what was coming 1 week in advance. And, you know, he said that we're going to destroy Lebanon's infrastructure. And that was a restatement of a military doctrine, the flattening doctrine. There's a Hebrew word for flattening. I forget what that is. And that doctrine is that in the next war with Hezbollah, Israel is just going to flatten Lebanon. It's going to flatten Beirut. It's going to destroy, you know, it's quote unquote a doctrine of using extremely disproportionate force, because they figure that's the only way they can beat Hezbollah, apparently. So they told us they were going to do it a month in advance. There's some other hints, too, alongside Benny Gantz's open warning. So I see this as very much part of what Israel's been doing in its war against the so-called axis of resistance of Hezbollah and Lebanon on the one hand, and Syria and Iran on the other. It has been dropping these, whatever they are, some kind of special weapon that creates a mushroom cloud on all of these countries and on the Persian Gulf in the past month. And they've told us that they're going into the next war with Lebanon with this doctrine of flattening Lebanon. So they told us all of this in advance. Yeah, but I also think, Richie, that, you know, keeping in mind your dictum that it's not just the Zionists, there are other parties involved in plotting evil too. I think we should consider the thesis that's been well expressed by somebody who writes under the name of Taxi in the UNS review, pointing out the geostrategic implications for the U.S. and Chinese empires. Because, you know, the background here is that on May 17th, a couple of days after Mike Pompeo had gone to Israel and ordered Netanyahu to shut down Israel's pact with China, Israel was about to hand over the port of Haifa to China. And Pompeo read him the Riot Act. He gave him a kind of an offer he couldn't refuse. And apparently Bibi tried to refuse. So 2 days later, the Chinese ambassador to Israel, Du Wei, suddenly was found dead. And the most plausible interpretation is that he was killed by American agents or American friends of them, maybe Israelis who were working with their American colleagues, to send the strongest possible message that no, Israel, you are not allowed to hand your port of Haifa over to the Chinese. So with that as the background, suddenly we have Lebanon about to bring China into the port of Beirut. And now, Richie, you may or may not know, I'm sure most of your listeners probably don't know, that Beirut and Haifa are the two big ports in the Eastern Mediterranean. Yeah, They've been in competition for a very long time. Israel has wanted to put the port of Beirut out of business ever since Israel was founded. And so now, suddenly, we have a situation where Lebanon was about to bring the Chinese into the port of Beirut, the big competitor to Israel's port of Haifa. And then suddenly, this horrible explosion happens. And so who benefits? Well, yeah, of course, Israel has been bombing the heck out of the axis of resistance with special weapons on an accelerating basis and telling us they're going to flatten Lebanon and they're going to destroy Lebanese infrastructure. But let's not forget the Americans who want, they are trying to kneecap the Belt and Road Initiative at every possible opportunity. So you can easily imagine a scenario where the U.S. gives the nod and the wink to Netanyahu go ahead and flatten the port of Beirut, and that'll send a message that we're not tolerating a Chinese presence in the Eastern Mediterranean.
This is hugely interesting, Kevin Barrett, and this is pretty much news to me. I don't have a team of researchers. I have my guests like you. So this is amazing. So the Chinese ambassador to Israel, now I knew that he died. I had read something online about, you know, on some of the, you mentioned UNS, which I look at. I do sometimes for my sins have a look at the front page of InfoWars as well. And I always check you out, of course, truthjihad.com, and you can read Kevin at veteranstoday.com as well. This is a fascinating development. So the Chinese ambassador is found dead, suspicious circumstances, and you wouldn't rule out the possibility that American agents did for him or did away with him based on their fear that Israel would do business with the Chinese in the port of Haifa. This is fascinating stuff, Kevin, and it makes some sense to me.
Yeah, well, it's not just fear. I mean, Israel had announced it was bringing China into Haifa, and Pompeo did an emergency visit to Netanyahu to tell him, you cannot do this. Yeah. He put a gun to his head, and Netanyahu didn't flinch. And so Pompeo went home, and 2 days later, one of China's biggest wonder guys, their Du Wei, who's way up at the top of the hierarchy there, a real genius China had sent to Israel specifically to get this kind of opening. Suddenly, he just turns up dead.
Amazing, right? So you and I, we've become very skeptical about coincidences over the years because of what we've read and seen. So no doubt there's an issue there. Why would the Chinese not scream bloody murder? Because you'd imagine they would do, or are they keeping their powder dry?
Oh, everybody has to keep their powder dry because, you know, you might wonder why would Lebanon and especially Hezbollah and Iran fail to scream from the rooftops that Israel just blew up the port of Beirut? Well, because if they do, then their population will demand major retaliation, which sets off a war. And they're going to say, and this is what Israel wants. Israel wants us to retaliate in a big way, and then it can go ahead and flatten us at its own timetable. So we're going to get our revenge here. The dish will be served cold, and it'll be at a time and place of our choosing where it serves our interests, not where we just respond to what they do to us so they can, you know, do what they want with us. So this is the reason why the Lebanese government wouldn't say anything about this. And as far as the Chinese not telling the truth about all sorts of things, the way they've been repeatedly attacked with biological weapons, possibly, quite likely, actually, including COVID, which is probably a U.S. germ weapon used against China, perhaps a Bankster germ weapon used against the world as well. The Chinese are really playing it low key because every year, every month, every day, China gets stronger. And, you know, so China has every reason to play super nice guy and to let the Americans and whoever else just slap them around right up until the day that they've become strong enough that if it comes down to a fight, they're going to win. So I think that's why China will never, you know, to admit to its own people that it's been attacked in a really horrible, scurrilous way.
Right.
Because its people would demand revenge.
It looks
and
weak.
The Chinese leadership,
yeah.
No, they don't want to fight right now.
Yeah, they might look weak in front of their own people. Kevin Barrett is our guest. Fascinating that it might have been the United States then, if there was a deliberate attack on the port. But still, on saying that...
No. Israel would have done it. The US would have given it the nod.
Would have given him the nod to do it. But again, one of the things that I can't get past is that it seems to be accepted that they were storing this ammonium nitrate in such, you know, large volumes for a long time. That's negligent in the extreme, Kevin. I mean, it's volatile stuff, this. Any of us that have, you know, looked at it, that have researched explosives over the years because of various false flag bomb attacks or genuine bombing attacks, we know this stuff is potentially, you know, catastrophic if it catches fire. You have to wonder how... I mean, that is incompetence in the extreme, isn't it? Let's be honest about it. If you're storing stuff like that on such a large scale for so many years and you're not moving it out of there or decommissioning it somehow or, you know, watering it down or diluting it or whatever, you've got some bloody questions to answer your own people, Kevin.
Well, you know, I question this whole story of a fertilizer. First, the explosion, I'm told by experts, doesn't look like a fertilizer explosion. But secondly, of course, normally ammonium nitrate doesn't explode on its own. If you wanted to make a bomb out of your ammonium nitrate, you would need to mix fuel oil, a lot of fuel oil with it, because it won't blow up by itself. And you know, for instance, if you wanted to blow up stumps on your property, I actually considered blowing up stumps with ammonium nitrate at one point, and then thought better of it because you know, this was in a period after 9/11 when if you had any connection to Islam or politics or anything, anybody looked at you crosswise and you're blowing stuff up with that stuff, they're going to get you might draw unwanted attention. So I never did that. But anyway, you need a lot of fuel oil to make it explosive. And so between those two facts, one is it actually isn't very explosive by itself. And number two, the explosion doesn't look like an ammonium nitrate explosion. Between those two things, it looks to me like this might be some kind of concocted cover story. It's always possible that ammonium nitrate was indeed sent in there the way we're told it was on this by accident by some Russian ship that was supposedly taking it to wherever. But if that was true, I wouldn't be surprised if that all would have been part of a cover story. I think, Israel might very well, we know Israel probably has been dreaming about blowing up the port of Beirut for, since it was founded, if
for
not
decades.
Before.
Yeah. So let me ask you this then. Why would the government of Lebanon then not, why did the government say, yes, it was the poorly stored and forgotten about ammonium nitrate? If Israel or the United States, I mean, you think maybe the US gave Israel the nod, and I'm not agreeing with any of this. I don't know. I'm not disagreeing with it either. I don't know. I'm happy to talk about it, of course. That's why we're here. But they would know then, or they would suspect it. Why would they not take that opportunity, the government, to tell its citizens, listen, we were attacked by Israel? Why? I don't know. Nobody can give me a good answer or explanation for that.
Because that means war. Because the citizens will demand that that Lebanon counterattack Israel in some roughly proportional way. And then that gives Israel its opportunity to have its big war that it at the time and place of its choosing. And the government of Lebanon right now doesn't want that war.
Are you sure the citizens of Lebanon would have demanded a military retaliation? Can you be absolutely sure of that? What if the Lebanese government was to say, listen, we're pretty sure that Israel did this. We're going to complain to, I mean, obviously Lebanon is not on the Security Council, but we're going to complain to the UN. We're going to kick off a fuss about this. You know, we're not going to retaliate because we don't want missiles and bombs to be landing in downtown Beirut. We're not going to do that. But we're telling you that Israel did it, or we think Israel did it. And we want you to know that. We're being upfront about it. And we're going to try and do something about it politically. You're convinced that the population would have wanted some sort of response?
Well, yeah. I mean, every time there's a big attack on any population, they always demand a response. And any leadership that doesn't respond just shows that it's too weak to respond and tends to lose face with the population. So it would have been a problem. But I mean, I would have supported something like that because, I'm one of these crazy people that believes in telling the truth and taking the consequences. But most people in positions of power are not that way. And we have to remember that Lebanon's government is very much divided. There are different forces, including a major group that's allied with Saudi Arabia, which is essentially a puppet of Israel or an ally of Israel at this point. And so there probably are suspicions of treason and the way that ammonium nitrate may have been set up to create a cover story might implicate some people in Lebanon. And they're just, they were just about to have the Hariri verdict unveiled, or the results of the Hariri investigation. Now, this Hariri, the former prime minister, was blown up by what was purported to be a car bomb. And it was Hezbollah was the patsy. And so the West and the Saudis and their Lebanese agents were planning to try to blame Hezbollah for this. And I don't think it's necessarily a coincidence that this Beirut port explosion happened just before that investigation was supposed to be announced, or the results were going to be announced. And it's very likely that bombing of Hariri was very much like this, that it was, it was done probably by Israel with help from the Saudi agents and in order to be used against Hezbollah. So I think it's a very, very complicated political thing going on, a very, very tough situation in Lebanon. And I'm not sure that there is such thing as the Lebanese government that can actually make a decision.
And you know, the thing, it's a desperate time for people there. The United States, of course, has put sanctions for some time on the country, and that's caused a lot of problems for the country. It needed a strike on the port or whatever, however it happened, it needed it like a hole in the head. Kevin Barrett is our guest. We've got about six, seven minutes left, Kevin, so I want to talk about this COVID thing, because there will be some listeners listening to us with great interest, and they will say, yeah, it's murky, Israel, the Saudis, the Jordan, Bahrain, the UK, France, you know, intelligence agencies all going around the world murdering people for reasons that are apparent maybe to me and you, but not apparent to a lot of people because they get their news exclusively from the BBC. But people might be listening to this tonight and they might say, you know what? What's happening now in our country in terms of how our government has been able to implement the most draconian regulations and rules and laws imaginable that we could have ever imagined, things that they're not likely to ever relinquish based on this idea that there's a virus going around that is deadly for us, even though it isn't, all the evidence says it isn't. We're looking at totalitarianism. I mentioned that word earlier on. We're looking at a very, very near future where we'll have a social credit system in society where we'll be judged based on our behaviour, we'll be expected to be inoculated in order to gain access to, I don't know, to leisure activities maybe, even to our places of work. There are people listening to this programme who says, you know what, Richie, you know what, Kevin, these problems in the Middle East and the dark actors like France and Israel and the US, and the none of this is going to matter in a few years' time, because these, you know, we could have our own Gaza, our own Gaza Strip, maybe, without the airstrikes from above in our own cities, with a kind of Orwellian dystopian nightmare existence that, again, maybe 10, 15 years ago, people would have thought never in a million years will people be told they have to be locked in their houses, will be told they can't meet people from their neighbourhood, will be told they can't work, will be told that they have to lose their livelihoods, will be told that they have to have a vaccine, and yet here we are. How do you feel about this? I mean, can you believe that this is happening right now in 2020? And there seems to be no opposition to it whatsoever.
Well, there's definitely a lot of opposition to it in the alternative media circles that you and I travel in.
Yeah.
It's almost universal opposition to it. But as far as figuring out how to stop it, I don't know. I mean, that demonstration in Germany was kind of heartening.
In Berlin,
where they got somewhere between 30,000 and a million people out into the streets. But yeah, I agree. It's true. It sort of puts things in perspective when, you know, we're worried about who's going to win the latest geostrategic tiff, and the whole world is heading for hell, you know, towards an Orwellian kind of society. And, you know, which country is in charge may not really matter. I know that people like Niall Ferguson are trying to convince us that if the Chinese win this new Cold War, then they're going to turn the world into an Orwellian slave plantation. But it's not clear to me that if they don't, anything's going to be any different, because, as you said, the West is going through this lockdown that looks like it was maybe modeled on the lockstep documents in that futuristic Rockefeller scenario from a decade ago about how if we had a pandemic, the Chinese system of total surveillance and control of the population would work well and it would look really good and everybody would have to adopt it. Wow. And so magically we got this pandemic and it's being instituted. And you're right. It's at some level, the technological imperative that's pushing the whole world towards Orwellian totalitarianism is in some ways a more fundamental problem than these geostrategic issues.
Yeah, they'll become moot, won't they? If this isn't arrested, if the progress of this lunatic Orwellian agenda that you described more eloquently than I did is not arrested, it won't matter what happens in the Middle East or anywhere else. And it's not just a pandemic. They're planning on using the hoax of man-made climate change to introduce some of these measures that you discussed as well. It'll be just incredible. I mean, I get emails on a daily basis from young parents. You know, I might get maybe two or three a day or maybe five or six a week. And they are terrified. They're terrified, Kevin, that if next year they decide that they would rather their youngster didn't have the COVID vaccine because they worry about the rushed nature of it and its potential to do harm. They worry that they might lose their children, Kevin. This is actually real. I can't believe sometimes that I'm actually saying this stuff out loud. You know, I really can't. And here we are. And you made a great point about that Rockefeller document. This is meant for the entire world. Israeli men, women and children have it coming. Palestinians have it coming. We have it coming. In Ireland, we have it coming here in the UK. And you're right, there is an opposition to it in the independent media. But a censorship is coming now, Kevin. We talked about this today briefly. It's not even a creeping censorship now, it's a stampede where any dissenting voices against, whether it's vaccines or whether it's against face masks, you know, we've seen it in the independent media when people have tried to talk about Israel or the UK, false flag terror, but now we're seeing it everywhere. You have the President of the United States, who I think is a world-class Muppet now, I really do. And God love him, he's no worse than Boris Johnson or Tony Blair. He's just the latest world-class Muppet. But still, I'll defend him. How dare a social media company censor the President of the United States, however stupid and ridiculous that president might be? That's a real sign of the times, Kevin, isn't it?
Absolutely, Richie. And they're using the pandemic to try to make independent thinkers out to be a threat to public health.
Yeah.
And they can use this metaphor that they already had developed of quarantining the conspiracy theorists.
Yeah.
That metaphor was developed more than 5 years ago as they came up with a plan to stop the so-called conspiracy theories from spreading by making sure that it was only within the sort of quote-unquote free speech zone, which is the playpen, where people who already know this stuff can interact with each other, but they wanted to quarantine us away from people who hadn't heard this stuff yet. And so that's been their strategy for at least 5 years, probably more like 10 or 15. And as they talk about this quarantining the conspiracy theorists to prevent the viral spread of conspiracy theories, or what they sometimes are calling now the conspiracy pandemic, they are instituting, you know, what they imagine are sort of hygienic measures of public discourse. And so that metaphor now has become even more front and center as they claim that the so-called conspiracy theorists, meaning the independent thinkers who question the most important of the official stories, are a threat to public health because they're going to convince people not to get vaccinated and to not wear face masks and to step outside the house when they shouldn't. And so now we're not just a threat to public sanity and public mental health by, you know, scaring the poor sheeple into believing, oh, my God, you know, the 9/11 was an inside job. But now we're a threat to the actual public health. People will die. Thousands of people will die because of us. And so we absolutely have to be silenced. And so that's the talking points that they've been using. And it almost, you know, if I were a conspiracy theorist, which I guess I am, I would really wonder whether the whole pandemic wasn't conceived with this in mind. At least in part.
Yeah, I'm not going to follow that because I agree with you. Mate, thanks for coming on today to share your thoughts on what's been happening in Lebanon and the plandemic or the scamdemic or whatever it is. Folks, you can find Kevin at truthjihad.com. You can find him at veteranstoday.com as well. You'll find links to Kevin's books at truthjihad.com, and he's well worth reading, believe you me. It won't be long before you're back, mate. So thanks for giving us your time today. And I always ask you on short notice as well. I like to keep you on your toes, Kev, but you never say no to me. So maybe you should start saying no to me and I'll give you more time in the future. But I love having you on. No, no, seriously. You're one of those I can go to late in the day. But when this was kicking off in Lebanon, I knew you'd be able to come on pretty quickly and give us a good report, good analysis on what's been happening there. So is there anywhere else I should direct people? I always say Truth Jihad and Veterans Today.
Yeah, I also write for UNZ.com, UNZ, and I write for American Free Press and for the Crescent International, the best Muslim magazine on current events. So people can look for those too.
Brilliant, mate. All the best. And I'm going to be away next week and the week after. So we'll connect again sometime in September and we'll see where things are then. But thanks again for your help as always.
Okay, thank you, Richie.
Legend, Kevin. Thanks very much. The great Kevin Barrett, live from Wisconsin, on the Richie Allen Radio Show. I've been speaking to Kevin for about 11 years now. Great guy. Really is. And you can say anything to Kevin. You can say anything to him. But I do get that. I had had a phone call from a friend of mine the other day. I won't mention him by name. And he is Jewish. He does like the program. And he said, one of the things you have to mention, Richie, is as much of a bashing as Israel gets on the program, you've got to talk about the unscrupulous behaviour and foreign policy decisions of your own countries. They're equally as bad, and sometimes they're worse. And of course he's right. Absolutely right. It's something that Zionists say when they get cheesed off at the fact that programmes like this exist. They don't like programmes like this. They, if there's one thing that an ultra-Zionist says that you've got to agree with, they say, well, your own countries are no better than the country that you're criticising. And of course, they're right. It's as simple as that. A lot of good guests coming up later in the week, including the great Gerald Celente. He'll be on with me on Wednesday. Off the top of my head, I can think of Gerald. That's it for today. Thanks again to Marilyn Hawes for coming on to talk about child abuse and those NSPCC reports in the first hour of the programme. If you missed that, it's well worth a listen. Back with you tomorrow, Tuesday, at 5 o'clock UK time. Until then, it's look after yourselves and one another, leaving you with the real thing. That's the last from me today. Bye for now. See you tomorrow. Bye now. Bye. It's just not playing. What's happening? It's one of those. That's the first mistake today. It's a real Monday mistake. Let's try that again. Yes. See you tomorrow.